Boom.
Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. We're delighted to have you here for this evening's distinguished and I'm sure really interesting panel discussion. I'm Sarah Holliday, the head of events, and I'm standing here solely to say what I just said and to add the following. Please silence your cell phones or anything that might disrupt the presentation. We appreciate it. And also that we do have copies of Suzanne Schneider's new book, Mandatory Separation, for sale on the table in the back corner, and she'd be happy to sign them following the presentation. Everything else will be explained and clarified and written by our panel, so I'll hand it over to them. Thank you.
Okay.
Try that again.
Hello.
My name is Ajay Singh Chaudhary. I'm the executive director of the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. I'm also a member of our core faculty, specializing in social and political theory. To my far left, I keep making this joke on everything I do, but nothing intended with that, is Tonia Alessandrini, who is a professor, is one of our faculty members, specializing in literature and also Middle Eastern studies. He teaches for us and also at CUNY. And to my left is Suzanne Schneider. She's the deputy director of the Brooklyn Institute of Social Research and a core faculty member specializing in history. And she is the author of, Mandatory Separation, Religion, Education, and Mass Politics in Palestine, an extremely timely book that is for sale in the back. And if you haven't noticed, we are in the beautiful space provided by the amazing people at the New York Society Library, which I was surprised to learn of is the oldest operating library. In fact, possibly the oldest library completely in New York City. It was founded in 1754. And still to this day operates for readers, writers, and families, and it is open, there's a wonderful exhibit going on out there right now, for reading, reference, and events like this one. So we are incredibly grateful to the people at the Society Library for putting this together. So, tonight we are talking about Susie's book, Mandatory Separation. We're asking some pretty big questions. For example, is religion a source of political stability and social continuity, or an agent of radical change, or something else? How should we understand religion and secularism? How should we understand things like nationalism, partition? I mean, this wasn't on our list, but this is something I was thinking about as I was reading this book. In what ways have political forces and motivations shaped timeless religious beliefs and practices and vice versa? And how, in light of these considerations, should we understand attempts to create a clear boundary between the religious and the political? And I would also add, between the national and the state, which is a really interesting question for us. This is going to be part of the Brooklyn Institute's podcast for social research. So while we'll have a Q&A at the end, just remember, you will be recorded. And for anyone who is listening at home, you can support the podcast of social research by becoming a member of our Patreon. There are many levels to contribute at, from lumpen disruptor to venture capitalist. We hope you consider contributing at one of these levels. Also, for people who don't know Brooklyn Institute of Social Research, we are an independent, critical, community-based education and research center based here in New York, but now operating nationally with classes in at least six states. So, without further ado, I think I will hand it over to my colleague, Susie, and she will talk a bit about mandatory separation.
Thank you, Ajay. Thanks to everyone who has come out tonight. It's very humbling to have smart people discussing your work, and an audience, no less. So thank you to everyone. I just want to take a moment also and recognize my parents, Joel and Mary Sue Schneider, who have come out to join us, and thank them for being here as well. So I'm going to kind of just speak for a few minutes here about some of the, what led me to this topic, why I wrote this book, but how I think that the things that I explore in the book kind of come outward and connect to a lot of ongoing contemporary questions. So, at the most basic level, why did I write a book about religion and education in Mandate Palestine? Really, I became interested in how groups of Jewish and Muslim, and I'm speaking here, I really mean Arab Muslim, although some of this stuff is also happening in South Asia as well, but really interested in how these groups of writers and intellectuals who were loosely categorized as modernists came to think about traditional forms of religious education among Jewish and Muslim communities. And the schools that they had in question are typically called the Cheder and the Kuteb. And these are kind of institutions that provided basic, rudimentary, primary education, reading, writing, sometimes arithmetic, using the Hebrew Bible and the Quran often as their textbooks. And these schools in the, increasingly from the end of the 18th century and especially into the 19th and early 20th, really became subjects of modernist ire. Because the education that they imparted was seemed to not be practical or responsive enough to any number of changing political circumstances. Remember, this is a time of tremendous economic transformation. We should not lose sight of the kind of the political economic aspects that are undergirding this transformation. And the demand that schools teach skills that were usually acquired previously in either the context of an apprenticeship or a family business, suddenly schools had to become the site for acquiring all sorts of quote-unquote practical skills. And the corollary to this is that the things that they did teach, right, this emphasis on religious texts, became defined as that which was not practical, that which had no kind of commercial value or use. So these schools, in addition to kind of being divorced from what was kind of commercially useful, they seem to represent the root of communal weakness. And this manifested itself differently in the Jewish and the Arab Islamic context, but there are still some overlapping similarities. For European Jews in particular, religious education of the type that was typical in Eastern Europe seemed to prevent the full integration of Jews into European societies. And for Muslims, it seemed to actually enable their literal colonization or at the very least commercial domination. And you find this kind of throughout the writings of modernists, that it is the backwardness of religious education that gives rise to political weakness, cultural and social stagnation, etc. So Palestine offers a pretty fascinating case study to bring these two communities and these two modernizing impulses with regard to education into conversation with one another. Not only did we have both communities that were present, but you also had a British colonial administration on the scene who governed Palestine during the Mandate period, which is roughly from the end of the First World War in 1918 until 1948. And the British came to the table with quite different ideas about the relationship between religion and mass politics. In particular, they believe that these two should be regarded as entirely distinct spheres of activity, and that to politicize religion was to corrupt its essence. It was almost a kind of an ontological sin to talk about a politicized version of religion. And I want to kind of zero in on kind of what type of a claim that is, because I'm going to return to this in a moment. So while writing this book, I really struggled with the fact that religion is a very slippery thing to analyze. What do we talk about when we talk about religion? Like other abstractions, religion is a placeholder with a lot of different associations, depending on whom you ask. Is it about faith or good deeds, individual salvation or communal strength? What makes something religious, and why does it matter? Actually, a kind of few of my kind of key insights from the book came out of this conceptual or theoretical difficulty. So yes, religion is an abstraction, but that does not mean that it is unchanging. It is also a socially embedded and historically evolving phenomenon. At the risk of stating the obvious, and despite all protestations to the contrary, religions change. Moreover, what a particular religion means or demands to its adherents at a particular moment is endlessly contested by the actual members of that community. In that sense, it makes much more sense for me to speak about Jews, to speak about Christians, to speak about Muslims, than it does to speak about Christianity, Islam, or Judaism as a singular essence. So this leads to one of the book's major arguments, or at least in, which is that the nationalist use of religious education during the mandate period should make us consider revising the very commonplace narrative that both Zionism and Palestinian nationalism were predominantly secular movements. You find this in the kind of historiography as a very, as almost a taken for granted assumption about the secularity of these movements. Now, I argue that they certainly were different, and they made different use of religious traditions than their forebears, but that does not equate to secularism, particularly if we think of the secular as characterized by disenchanted, rational calculations that is opposed to the supposed rationalism of religion. It also suggests that the surprise that many have expressed about the so-called return of religion in Israel and in Palestine is entirely misplaced. My book suggests there's actually much more of a continuum than people would like to admit. This narrative is particularly strong, I would argue, among liberal Zionists who tend to think that everything was just fine prior to 1967, and that Israel's ongoing problems are the fault of religious Jews, whether settlers or the ultra-Orthodox. Now, in contrast to this nationalist use of religious education that I detail in this book, the British colonial administration consistently promoted a view that religion was an apolitical practice, which is, I might want to just like take a moment and let that sink in, because it is so contrary to the way I think that we now think about the relationship between religion and radicalism. But to assert that actually the key to holding down radical politics was the promotion of good religious values and good religious education, this is the cornerstone of British colonial thinking at the beginning of the 20th century. You see this expressed in a number of ways, one of which was the sectarian governance of education, whereby it was only religious communities who were able to make claims for any sort of educational autonomy. To be a national community was an inherently risky thing, and to be deemed somewhat of a dangerous faction. But to be a religious community was something that was deemed to be, you know, okay. And now the British were right in noting that both Palestinian and Zionist camps were in fact intermingling religion and politics in novel ways. But I argue that they were wrong in thinking that this was some sort of an aberration. In fact, it is the norm, and it typified British colonial politics as well. The idea that mixing religion and politics was improper, in fact, rested on an illusory sense of British and truly Christian neutrality, where it is taken for granted as the norm against which all others are defined. So, for instance, administrators could speak of Christian schools in Palestine as a neutral meeting ground for the temperamental natives, where they could forge some sort of Christian character, which was deemed to be apolitical. And they contrasted this to the, you know, political activism with the particularism that they found in Jewish and Muslim schools. So, in the work, I call this a politics of denial. This is a term that I've coined to kind of refer to this entire matrix of claims that you find among British colonial administrators, but not only them, about the neutrality of certain politics and certain policies, and constantly denying that they actually have anything to do with politics. So, for instance, with education, we are constantly finding reference to pedagogic necessity, to psychological need, to all sorts of kind of scientific discourses to justify certain policies, and a refusal to admit that those policies had very real political implications. So, why does this matter? Well, I'd like to think that the book kind of opens up a few vistas for consideration. One of them is religious affiliation as a form of identity politics. But it's important to note that this is not an age-old phenomenon. This is not part of a natural order that has always existed. Historically, people have organized their political claims around a lot of other axes other than religious identity. And in fact, there are often multiple overlapping identities were quite common in Palestine prior to the First World War. kind of something is best chronicled by Rashid Khalidi. Now you hear a lot of reference, though, to these age-old sectarian conflicts, but we know that that just plasters over a far more complicated matrix of interactions between communities. We know, for instance, that there are many periods in history in which members of various religious groups lived alongside one another without a great deal of animosity. How and why religious identity becomes a motivating factor for conflict in some instances and not others is a historical question. It is not a theological one. And it can only be answered by looking beyond the boundaries of religion per se. So there is, in other words, nothing essential or necessary about a religious conflict. What makes religious identity politics in the modern period different, though, is that people are now able to make claims to a much larger, much more invasive, and much more effective state apparatus. And moreover, the modern state doles out a lot more goodies than pre-modern empires. And who is eligible to receive them is a central conflict that often gets channeled through the grid of religious identity. So we can and should think about religious identity politics in contemporary contexts as being about control over the state and its resources just as much or even more than it is about theology or religious practice. Finally, we also see a kind of something that evolves, particularly in changes in pedagogy and the creation of textbooks and the central administrative apparatus for education departments, is that the state increasingly gets to decide what is and what is not religious in ways that are unprecedented during the course of the 20th century. You can look at this in the production of textbooks for religious studies beginning in the early 20th century, but you can find much more contemporary examples of this. Current debates about conversion in the state of Israel, with a central rabbinate recognizing conversions done by certain rabbis but not other rabbis. What you see is the adjudication of what is and what is not Judaism by a state. But this is not kind of unique to Israel. You can certainly look at instances like Saudi Arabia and the attempt to kind of propagate an official version of Salafi Islam through the mechanism both of education and also missionary establishments throughout the world. All of these kind of attempts, though, they threaten, I think, to overpower a polyvocalism that is inherent in religious traditions. That the state is intent on stamping out at the moment that it wants to seize religion for political purposes. So what are the implications of all of this for the contemporary moment? I'm going to just leave you with a few kind of thoughts here and then kick it back to Tony and Ajay, who I'm sure will add many more. But on one hand, I do think that we, and really liberals in particular, do rob themselves of some pretty tremendous resources when they think they have nothing to learn from religious texts or traditions. And it also creates a sense of unnecessary antagonism within our social movements and between forces that might otherwise find common ground. Now, the separation of religion and politics, we might say, is a laudatory goal, and I think deeply necessary, but there are a few caveats here. It is just as necessary in some ways to protect religion from the state as to protect the state from religion. State religion makes me very queasy, largely because of the flattening of religious life that entails, and the closing down of pluralism in practice and thought, and the foreclosing of certain emancipatory potential that we find in religious traditions. So, kind of a second caveat to this is that if they are thinking about secularism, is that what we think of as secular is not often neutral. It is often lapsed Christianity, and it's inherently alienating to many, not because they can't wrap their minds around secularism or the separation of religion and politics, but simply because they're not Christian and they don't want to be. And if you kind of want to find an example of the way that certain kind of assumptions that are deeply Christian continue to order what we might consider to be kind of a secular political realm, you can look at something around like the discourse of individualism, for example, or the kind of cult of the entrepreneur. I had the opportunity to teach a Brooklyn Institute course about individualism, and we really traced a genealogy of thought about individualism, starting from Luther, the notion of the individual accountable soul, through Kant, through the autonomous will. And what do we find? We find very deeply Protestant assumptions about the role, the centrality of the individual as opposed to the community as the central unit of salvation at heart in a lot of our political discourse still around individualism. So I'm just kind of throwing this out as an example. So So finally, I just want to say that, at least in my opinion, there is no essential relationship between religion and politics. And that when we think about how religion can be motivated, I think one of the things that my book opens up is that, yes, it can be the driving force behind incredibly nostalgic and retrograde politics on one hand, or the driving force between incredibly radical and emancipatory ones on the other. That is the nature of a contested and historically embedded phenomenon.
I think Tony's gonna give a few remarks, and then I will, and then we'll talk about it.
Hi. Yes. So as was mentioned, my name is Tony Alessandrini. I teach as part of the Brooklyn Institute, also at CUNY. Delighted to be here tonight. I'm so happy to get a chance to talk about this book. This room is amazing. It's like super Jamesian kind of crazy. For people listening to the podcast, like, you're totally missing this. So we'll put some pictures on the site. So there are a number of things I want to say, and the comments will come. I'll sort of make some comments from the book, which is, has been mentioned, for sale and back, and which is a really fascinating book. And use that maybe to sort of turn out into the conversation a little more generally. And I'll say in a very sort of almost simplistic way, one reason why I'm so grateful to have had the chance to read this book is as someone who talks more than occasionally about Palestine-Israel and encounters exactly, and you've already mentioned this, the kind of the notion of the primordial religious struggle, the idea that this is, you know, some kind of ancient feud grounded in religion. So you know, often my first kind of rhetorical move is to say, and again, probably an overly simplistic, schematic way, well, it's not a religious conflict, it's a political conflict. And you know, very often that's the way to sort of get out of that realm, and sort of like, let's take the religion out of it and think of this as a kind of a contemporary political problem, you know, first. And you know, what this book does, what the historical work of this book does is, of course, like, complicate both those categories. So I'll probably still say a version of that, right? But I mean, I think being called upon to think of what we mean when we talk about a religious conflict rather than a political conflict or vice versa is really important, not just in terms of like the specific conflict here, but lots of conflicts, right, in our moment. So I mean, that might be one thing we could talk about. I mean, this question of, I think one of the ways we framed it was drawing a line between religion and politics, which we probably want to continue to do, and at the same time be complicated, but not so complicated that we'd stop doing it. Right? That's because of the necessity of it. So just a couple of moments. There's a moment sort of relatively early in the book, which I found really valuable. And again, I mean, this book is grounded in a lot of really important work over the past couple of decades, kind of questioning this notion of secularism. And let's just sort of say the grounding of secularism. I say this as someone who has a fondness for secularism and sort of thinks of myself as secular and is, you know, as a critic. And I should say, I mean, I always, whenever I'm doing one of these Brooklyn Institute things, I always at some point have to say, I'm not a historian. And this is a book written like a very beautifully grounded historical book. So I speak not as a historian and someone who like learns from historians as much as I can. But there has been this really interesting work on the sort of grounding of secularism, and specifically the way that secularism, as we think it sort of in the West, comes out of, let's just sort of say, it's Christian secularism. I mean, it's sort of the notion of secularism itself comes out of a kind of Christian understanding, or Christian, sort of Western Christian grounding of the relationship between religion and secular, which of course is a problem when you start trying to move that around to different places and different times and different contexts. But you know, even more interestingly, there's a moment early in the book where Susie is talking about the way religion was thought of in the Mandate period, and then sort of zooms into the contemporary, and I'm just gonna read the quote. "The notion is still so prevalent in contemporary polemics that our politics are rationally guided and easily distinguishable from religion in a way in which others are not, is a central feature of what I've coined the politics of denial." And I think, you know, there's the question of religion and secularism in there, and there's also the question of rationality, right? Sort of like political rationality and both the desire to sort of attribute that to ourselves and the desire to sort of deny that to, you know, the others that we're sort of opposing. And so that might be one thing to think about. Again, as someone who generally likes rationality, But you know, the question of how rationality gets sort of wielded or used in that kind of way. So that, I mean, that was one thing I wanted to really highlight.
Can I just stop for a second? Yeah. I mean, when you're saying this, it really, this is often how kind of Hamas gets narrated, okay. Right? These are religious fanatics as opposed to the kind of rational violence of the state. And there's a lot of this rhetoric as, you know, that we can basically dismiss any number of legitimate political claims by labeling something as religious, because religious has this association and connotation of fanaticism. So that is the work that religion and secular do as labels that we deploy from a position of power.
I think that's right. I think that's such a perfect contemporary example of that. I think it's also, and I think the book gestures towards this, and maybe our discussion will pick up on this a little more, it's a kind of trap that the left can sometimes fall into as well, right? Where we sort of think, especially think of sort of our kind of contemporary context, where we think of sort of red state religiosity as this kind of unthinking, irrational reaction. I think there are other ways to analyze it. Doesn't mean that one has to like it or approve of it, but I mean to sort of dismiss it in that way and to sort of think of our own politics as grounded rationally, therefore. I think so. Yeah. I mean, I completely agree about the way Hamas gets understood in this context. Which I guess actually that sort of helps me get to the second point, which comes from the two appropriately named chapter border clashes, which is the next to last chapter, which at this particular moment seems like all too apt. The question of border clashes. But the question of the way that the British, sort of British mandate understanding of Zionism and of sort of the question of Jewish identity as both national and religious, and the way that kind of, because there is this kind of predetermined separation of those things, kind of the way you said it, like sort of political groups are dangerous and bad, but religious groups are okay because grounded in tradition and therefore non-threatening. So when a religious formation also becomes a political formation or also becomes a state-building formation, right? I mean, that's when, well, lots of things happen. So just sort of thinking about that moment and thinking about, again, I mean, the way that overlap happens, not just the question that, like, religion can maybe be not just sort of traditional bounded, but also the way that, right, that kind of understanding of that separation blinds us to sort of, right, certain kinds of overlaps between, like, and certainly this, I mean, certainly now, thinking of American nationalism, the overlaps between American nationalism, whiteness, Christianity, right? I mean, there are massive overlaps there, which can't be elided into each other, but also can't really be ignored. So I'm interested to talk about that. And the last thing, and then I kind of a question, not quite a challenging question, but a question, nevertheless. But this beautiful moment towards the end of the book, talking about the British, the way the British talked about schooling in Palestine, the way school, and sort of this sort of arguing, I think the way you put it is like, they spend the first half of the mandate arguing for the sort of that it would be impossible to have a kind of binational model, and then the second half of the mandate, like, kind of tisking that you just, but now it's too late.
How did this happen?
Exactly. How did we find ourselves?
That's exactly right. They're like, literally, like, I don't know what happened here. If under a different administration, maybe things could have been different. It's like, you were the administration.
Which I think is, you know, and reading that, I mean, that feels so apt for the way that the, you know, quote unquote Palestine-Israel conflict gets talked about, right? As this kind of mystified, kind of like, how did things get so bad? And as though international actors were not involved, as though there wasn't this whole kind of, I mean, when you were talking about Christian schools as this kind of neutral ground, you know, it's kind of how Camp David functions now, right? It's like, we'll bring all the kind of the lunatic fringes to Camp David and sort it out, right? I mean, as though these things were sort of happening. So that just seems such an apt way of thinking about the way this conflict is still thought about, you know, this kind of, like, simultaneous, like, disbelief, disavowal, you know, kind of, how did it get to this point? False innocence is sort of the way I want to describe that. And then the question, and then I'll kick it over to Ajay and maybe we'll start with this, but there's a great point also towards the, I guess it is in the conclusion, where you first quote, if people know that the great British Marxist cultural theorist, Raymond Williams, a quote which I didn't actually know from the Sociology of Culture, where he says, there was no way to teach a man to read the Bible which did not also enable him to read the Radical Press. Which is nice.
That's great.
Yeah, it's nice. And then you sort of rephrase that as, there was no way to teach a man to read the Bible or the Quran that did not also enable him to read it as a radical text. Right. So the religious text itself is a radical text. And I'll say, it's funny, I was talking to a friend who is a historian earlier today, and I was like, oh, I got this great Randall Williams quote. And I read that to her, and she kind of went, not sure. Like, and I think part of the hesitation was, I mean, absolutely, yes. I mean, absolutely is this way, you know, within the American kind of abolition, but, you know, the kind of the desire to teach, you know, sort of only sort of like, teach one only enough to sort of put one in a kind of tradition, like religious tradition, but not enough to sort of challenge it. But I guess there is also a kind of, for lack of a better word, religious model of reading that would say religious texts kind of cancel out secular texts, right? In other words, like if one reads the Bible, one doesn't have to read it, right? And it's not that that's clear, to limit religious thinking or religious reading or whatever you want to call it to that would of course be totally wrong. But it does exist. So in other words, the possibility, it seems there's not an automaticness to going from reading the Bible to reading the Radical Press, and even the possibility that being taught to read the Bible in a particular way will make one be unwilling or unable or, you know, afraid to read the Radical Press or to read the text themselves as radical. So I guess I wanted to also sort of throw that in, and maybe it's a way of asking, after we've done the critique of secularism, if there's still a value to thinking about things like secular reading, right? I mean, even if one wants to take religion seriously, you see what I'm trying to get at. It's awkward, but I'm trying to sort of think about it.
I mean, if I just hop in for a second, I mean, I think the Williams quote really is far simpler than that, is really just talking truly about the acquisition of literacy, right? Which is not a kind of common trait prior to modernity in Europe, and obviously the kind of the dual developments of the Protestant Reformation on one hand and the invention of the printing press on the other hand kind of facilitate this reading vernacular, which was quite uncommon prior to the modernity. And I really look at this as a type of a skill set that once acquired can go many places. And I actually think that the same is true about having the basic kind of familiarity or skill set with working with religious texts. I don't think that criticism is inherently secular. I think there's a model of criticism, particularly Talmudic criticism, which was quite a norm in a kind of a contemporary academy, which I myself engage in quite frequently, and that there is, you know, the notion of kind of these absolute boundaries when we're engaged in that type of hermeneutic exercise. And certainly, there are definitely people who want to erect them, but there are also people who say, yeah, well, that's just kind of, you know, baloney. So you don't have to necessarily abide by them.
I think I'm actually going to pick up, I have a little, you know, a couple points that I want to add, but I actually want to pick up on this Raymond Williams thing. Am I not doing it? If maybe from my own sort of disciplinary, prejudice. So I was recently reading a very poor book of political theory that's considered okay. But it actually makes this incredibly conservative argument. And it actually turns around printing of the Bible, printing press, Gutenberg and whatnot. And it sort of makes this sort of like hilarious, almost like Malcolm Gladwellian, like, did you know? And it's like, did you know when we got the printing press, people, you know, they were able to read the Bible, and then they were able to read things, and the status quo was threatened. And it says this like as if A, that isn't a thing that's kind of well known, and B, as if I'm like, yeah, that's okay. The status quo happened, then things got pretty rough, and there was 100 years of wars of religion. It was a pretty ugly scene. But also, like, I kind of, yeah, if you had to give me a choice, yeah, I'd probably go into what came after than what came before. And this this sort of, I think, gets at an interesting sort of question of what it means to do this sort of secular criticism versus religious criticism. And I imagine, Tony, you have in mind The World, the Text, and the Critic by Ibn Said, which is a fantastic book for those of you who haven't read it. But where I might quibble with Said a little bit in that what he calls secular criticism in that book, which is something I would defend like to the death, right? The idea that the force of text is only, the force of text does not reside in this sort of metaphysical weight that lies somehow behind the text, but rather in its claims, in its beauty, in its argument, in all kinds of things, in the emotion, in my relationship to it, that's where the power of a text lies. The funny thing about calling this secular criticism, I think this is maybe where Susie, you're coming in, is that that feels very much of a piece with a certain kind of like Talmudic reasoning, as Susie has said. No, the, like everyone's favorite story everyone's favorite Haggadah, these stories, right, from the Talmud, is this bit from Baba Metzia.
Like one of us had to tell the story tonight,
but like, right, it's super, super famous. It's called The Oven of Acnai. In this story, right, like, I think is it Rabbi Akiva? It's one of the great rabbis, I think it's Akiva, is arguing with a bunch of other rabbis about how they can make an oven kosher, right? I think it's about
the
like
status of the oven.
Yeah,
whether
or not, I think it's about how far apart the bricks are, if I remember correctly. Anyway, so they're sitting there, and what are they doing? They're reading text and arguing about text. And Rabbi Akiva, who sort of is the acknowledged sort of authority, says, "Look, come on, guys. You know I'm always right. Just like I'll prove it to you. If I'm right, you know I'm gonna get it wrong. Oh, this tree will jump like 10 units, whatever units they were. And lo and behold, the tree jumps 10 units. And you know the rabbis say." Oh, but the law, and then quoting from Deuteronomy.
It's the river runs backward first. There's all these kind of proofs that are brought, and then a bakol, right, this kind of voice from above comes and says, the Torah is not in heaven, right?
No, you skip, you skip the comedic buildup. But yeah, so he makes all these sort of magical claims to authority that Said would correctly call, I believe, religious criticism. Theological criticism, right? These claims to authority, but in the end, the rabbis insist, even after a voice from heaven says the law is with Rabbi Akiva, the rabbis are saying, nope, well, we've got this law here, we've got to read it, that's all we have to do. And this is so fascinating because it both sort of confirms the power and the sort of beauty of that kind of secular criticism, but it also tells me that that thing existed before the advent of secularization. And I say this as someone who is a strict materialist and a strict secularist, I guess, in many senses of the word, which I think brings me to a couple of things that I wanted to say. Many of them echo Tony's points, particularly on this sort of hilarious, it's not hilarious, I shouldn't use the word hilarious, but there is this sort of way in which you can watch pieces fall into place, and of course hindsight is 20/20. But particularly with what the British are doing, and you're like, oh my God, just don't do that. Like, oh my God, put the Bible back in the drawer. Like you're just like, what are you doing? And the same thing with the sort of labor Zionists. I mean, that section of the book, when you talk about the labor Zionists subbing in biblical history instead of even any form of historiography, whether it be, von Ranke or whatever. I'm just like, oh my God, can you guys not see what's going to happen here? But this does lead me to an interesting question that comes up in the book, but that maybe is more alive in today and with our politics, which is in that sort of creation of a nation state, right? The story here is part of the story of the creation of a nation state. And one of the things I've always found most fascinating about the sort of way in which certain political ideas, like Susie was saying, like political religion is considered uniquely irrational, uniquely unsuitable, right? You quote at the end of the book, Sam Harris, I think, or it's like Sam Harris and a bunch of other yokels, saying something like, right, that like, oh, like religion is the clear irrational thing. And the funny thing about someone like Sam Harris saying this, right, is of course he's an extreme nationalist. As if that's not a extremely odd, abstract, metaphysical category, very hard to prove in the existence of in the world, and yet it's somehow assumed to be okay. It's somehow assumed by the British to be quite natural but threatening in the colonial period, and is assumed by so many commentators today to be a sort of natural thing. And in fact, even amongst many sort of academic critics, they look at that phrase nation state and they sort of tend to lean on the state part as opposed to on the nation part. And this isn't so much a question as it is like, it's something I really want to think about is especially in this moment, is nationalism and its relationship to this story. The development of nationalism, we think of nationalisms, as Tony said, here in the United States, being extremely, extremely Christian. I can think of ones that are sort of post-Christian and Christian, right? The French essentially now have a choice between an authoritarian post-secular vision and authoritarian Christian vision. And that's what they have, that's the range of their politics now. Sorry for if there are any Emmanuel Macron fans in the audience. But this is a really interesting sort of question to me. It's like, what metaphysic is allowed? Or should we in fact not be thinking about sort of a secular politics as rather as a non-metaphysical politics? This is, again, I'm sort of betraying my, I'm a political theorist, this is the kind of thing I like to think about. The other thing that I think is really important to mention here actually has very little to do with some of the most hot button issues, but it's something that stood out to me as incredibly important, which is education. And maybe again, this is a disciplinary prejudice, but the, not just disciplinary, but a sort of job prejudice. The British view education as a form primarily of stabilization. This is fascinating to me. It's certainly not my view of education, except in maybe an extremely weird redemption kind of way. But it's also something that you see appearing more and more. In fact, you'll see two different versions, for example, of a sort of renewal of civics education programs, like, for example, here in the United States. One of which I think is pretty good, right? It's like, oh, you should be familiar with how your like government works. You should be familiar with like its ins and outs, its history, what political and economic basis it stands on, how you can interact with it, how you can engage critical thinking. In fact, kind of critical thinking can sometimes be a sort of funny thing, but you know, how we can bring all this kind of disciplinary weight and thinking and intellectual inquiry into our civic lives. Wonderful. I've seen that under the same exact rubric, something that is exactly British colonial education, which is, the sort of like the youth of today have forgotten the evils of the world. They've forgotten the gulag. They've forgotten Auschwitz. They don't know how bad it could be. They don't know the struggles that we went through. So we should have a good civic education that indoctrinates them into knowing how wonderful the status quo is. And this is essentially, and it's really funny because I did not actually know this about mandate Palestine education. This is British, this is colonial education. This is colonialism. We actually have our own, you know, people talk about this technologies returning from the colonies to the metropole, and usually we think about this as technologies of control, right? Surveillance, bombing. There's a wonderful book by Smith Lindquist on bombing about this. But right, like all these sort of mechanisms of violence and control. This is a mechanism of pedagogy, test-driven in the colonies, and now sort of being brought home to tame something. So I think I'll just leave it there and throw it back to you, Suze.
Thank you. Thanks to you both for these kind of rich comments. I'm not going to get to, I'm sure, all of them, but you know, on the education piece, right, this is obviously kind of dear to our heart. This is kind of what we do for a living. Yes, it is extraordinarily strange, this view, because it's not only that, right, the British view in this period, religion is something which is apolitical, but they also view education as something which is apolitical.
Yes.
And if it is politicized, then that is something that is improper, but that is a kind of a transgression of sorts. And what that does is allied over the fact that modern state-based mass education is political to its core. The state's interest in public education has historically been bound up with the desire to create industrious citizens, to create revenue from in taxation as kind of economies have shifted. So the idea that we can kind of create some sort of like idyllic education that's going to be divorced from mass politics is just complete illusion. And the only question for me is what type of politics we're going to have in our education. And as Jay gestured to before, there are really different programs which are being bandied about, but it is precisely actually through denying that education is political, right, through a kind of a politics of denial, that very conservative forces that want to kind of reinstate the status quo actually gain some of their power. So we're told not to politicize education, which again completely betrays the extent to which education ever and always political.
And I just want to underline something you said. When one makes the claim that education is inherently political, that does not mean, okay, let's dump public education. It in fact does force you out of this exact formation that Susie outlines in the book, this politics of denial, into saying, actually, no, I need to embrace a politics, and I have to sort of choose. And there's a difference between embracing a politics and enforcing and indoctrinating a politics as well.
The other kind of point I'd want to kind of bring back to something I argue in the book, you know, this type of thinking about education as a kind of a neutral practice in character formation, I argue actually had some pretty dire consequences. Because British educational policy was always formulated on the basis of purported, right, pedagogic need or kind of psychological best interest of the pupil, and very rarely ever thought of within a larger matrix about what are these policies leading toward. So the decision to create and recognize separate school systems already very early in the mandate period, in the early 1920s, for Jewish and Arab students respectively, this was viewed as something that had to be done on the basis of kind of pedagogic necessity. We can't possibly put these people together. And then, yes, but with no overriding appreciation that such a policy was only set up this country for one thing, and that one thing was partition. And that the denial that education had an inherently kind of political impact also prevented them from making some sort of positive contribution to politics through education. And in this, they were actually quite distinct, I argue, from kind of the Ottoman Empire that preceded them. And you know, the Ottomans fell very far short of this lofty goal, but they really did view education, particularly at a higher level, as a way of acculturation between the various different communities that lived in the empire. Whereas kind of mandatory British administration kind of consistently denies that there's anything political here to see, that none of this has any impact on politics whatsoever, and then lo and behold, I guess it does. And there's a kind of a sense of, yes, a great surprise in the late 1940s, kind of as the Second World War is coming to an end in the Colonial Office, saying, oh, well, I guess maybe we should have done things differently, but it seemed like we couldn't, and we didn't, so alas.
And there's always the question, and this comes to me with this politics of denial thing, right? There's politics of denial as a sort of ideology where it's truly unseen. And then there's a politics of denial where people actually avow, right? These institutions are neutral. And it seems like they're sort of playing at both on occasion. And the reason I say this is like, clearly there are, I'm thinking actually less of the case of Palestine, I'm thinking more of the case of South Asia, where there was a clear interest, all right? The British ruled South Asia much longer than they ruled Palestine, and there was a clear self-interest in creating a new mass identity for Hindu Indians. And they do this, and they claim that this is just, oh, this is the way it has to be, right? That, look, the communities pre-exist, but actually the communities do not recognize themselves in those ways. And it just so happens to be convenient that this allows them to then say that the previous rule was illegitimate, right? Because it was a small foreign minority, ruling an oppressed majority. And of course, this partition was something that Susie just raised, and it was throughout this book, I was thinking, this way of trying to separate these things out so neatly and so distinctly has to inevitably lead to the logic of partition. The sort of three great cases of partition in the 20th century, right? Greece, Turkey, Israel, Palestine, and India, Pakistan, all huge disasters. This kind of balkanization, purification of the nation, the idea of a complete identity of national, of people and state, as opposed to some kind of a more politically based identity or other based identities, dare I even mention a class-based one, proved to be incredibly bloody, not only in Palestine, in fact, far bloodier in South Asia and in Greece and Turkey.
Just to follow on a couple of things. Since we mentioned the South Asian case, I'm thinking, the book by Gori Viswanathan, A Mass of Conquest, which sort of makes a similar argument about the development of English literature, really, as a discipline. And it's essentially developed in the colonies as a kind of colonial form of education and comes back home, to the center, in very much the way that you would just describe it. And partly, and I was thinking as you were talking about this, and maybe this could be part of the basis of the discussion, that kind of the two versions of education you're describing, two versions of like civic education you're describing, I mean, it increasingly in this country sounds like the two versions that are given to us, if you would like, for like elite institutions versus, you know, so let's say sort of public. I say this as someone who teaches at a public community college in most of my day job, you know, and for sure, when one thinks of civic education in like urban public settings, it's very much like an instrumentalized view. And so, I mean, one question would be, and I know this is taking us a tiny bit away from the question of religion, but not totally, you know, if there is this sort of split within, I'm thinking again of like something William Williams says about the British education system, that is, that's the way he puts it, but to something to the effect of like, it just reminds me of like the sort of the two-tiered system. Yes. Seems a little too much like our social system to be comfortable. Yeah. Like, it just seems just slightly a little too related. The other thing, I mean, there's a point that's made, I mean, a couple of times in the book, I mean, early on, sort of throughout, the power that resides in naming certain things religious as compared to not religious, right? The certain power in the naming. And it feels like we're starting to talk about the power in naming certain things political, right? I mean, and not political. I mean, there is the question of like the not clearly political versus the kind of like, I'm not seeing it as political, but there's also the power to say, well, look, you're politicizing education, but you're just doing your job, right?
Yeah. I was actually thinking of, Tony, precisely this point, kind of in response to school shootings, right, the accusation that gun control advocates are trying to politicize school shootings, as if this is not a kind of, as if politics, the realm of politics does not extend to the question of violence, does not extend to the question of education, that, how else might we look at this? But that's a dirty word, right? To politicize something, and that it's very fascinating how that kind of functions. I think within a greater neoliberal discourse where the political is seen to be shrinking, and the advocates of that's exactly what they want, is for the kind of space occupied by politics, the space occupied by the state to retreat, and even the areas where one can think of making political claims as being in retreat.
Hello, there was a recent article, and unfortunately I cannot remember the title, by Arjuna Mundurai, where he talks about, he uses some interesting, I might quibble with some of his terminology, but he makes a sort of interesting argument about Gaza and Hamas and the sort of religiosity. It connects in my mind to the end of the book, that same sort of Sam Harris moment, right, where it's part of the putting religion beyond the bound of politics is also saying, if it's a religious thing, what can we do? It's unsolvable. You can't talk to religious people. My God, how would you even do that? And the thing that Upper Durai says is like that is I think very fascinating and very disturbing and very difficult for this particular moment of thinking about far right nationalism in many places. He says actually Gaza's pretty good. Gaza's pretty good for you. Why? Not because you're like sort of a caricature of some like disturber Jew, right? Bloodthirsty and all this kind of stuff. No, it's useful because it presents a persistent, controllable form of legitimacy for your government and for your state. And this is an incredibly powerful argument, and it's a very disturbing one, because it says not so much that, the Gazans and Palestinians more broadly will be sort of wiped out or something like this, but they actually, it is in the interest of the state of Israel to preserve them in a separate and incredibly unequal situation to create a legitimation mechanism into the future. And this is a very sort of, this is part and parcel of this kind of idea of saying, oh, certain things we can talk to and certain things we can't. But again, it's not so much a actual philosophical claim as it is a convenient theological one. Tony, I can see.
I'm trying to think, I'm just looking at our time and wondering if maybe we should, Ajay, should we open the circuit, maybe open up for questions from the audience? I mean, we view this as both a conversation, obviously, with us, but also we want to hear people's thoughts and I'm sure there are other kind of questions and comments that we can respond to as well. So if anyone wants to jump up to the microphone.
So just rock over to the mic. Sorry, there's a man right there.
Yeah.
Well, you have to come over here.
Yeah.
I mean,
so we can, everyone will be able to hear you better.
You go first.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Thanks. Sure. So, fascinating subject, actually. So, I'm trying just to, it's a couple of points. Just for you, it's your beer as up.
Oh, did I get the wrong tone?
Yeah. Not the story, but it was Rabbi Elazar. And
talk right into
really?
It.
So,
yeah. Good.
So,
perfect.
So obviously, coming from the Middle East, just a couple of points. I think it's hard to avoid the notion that the people who started Israel, the Chalutzim, the
pioneers,
pilgrims, were completely unreligious, I mean, 100%. Why was that Judaism coming and Zion? Again, that's my view, obviously, from thinking about that for 40 years plus. I'll call it a marketing notion. They had to rally the Jewish people from outside. They were very small in numbers. So, and they left their homes, they left their fathers, they left the cheder. Nobody there studied in the cheder. Actually, the cheder was wiped out in the 40s and just recently started to come back. So they had to rally again around the notion, around something, and that was, at the basic of it, that was it. But they didn't, they had different celebration, chagim, everything was changed. But the notion of the people of Israel coming back could rally everybody into it. But then came the notion of Judaism into this whole idea, saying, okay, if it's Jewish and it's religious and it's based on the Bible, then we religious people, we know more about it. And that's, I think, where all of that dynamic started to come. Actually, if you go back, I think, to all this period of the British, I think the language is a big one.
Yes.
The Hebrew language that came together really brought the people together in an unprecedented way. And in Hebrew we say Ivrit. Ivrit was also the notion they were saying against the British, we want an Hebrew or Medina Ivrit. that Judaism, Medina Yehudit, came only in the declaration of independence. And again, I think that was the conflict, because the Palestinian, I know them less, but just as an understanding, they said, we're not Muslims. So they said, we've been here hundreds of years. My grandfather, great-grandfather, this is my village. That's my identity. So when Jewish people, when they had to say, okay, we are here 2,000 years, that's actually the whole conflict. So I believe it was, you know, a marketing idea goes bad, if I need to summarize it.
So I do take up this kind of claim in the book extensively about the secularity of the Chavutzim and contest it actually. And I think that they certainly were different. They certainly were not religious in the way that their kind of forefathers were, but I don't think that they had kind of ditched the kind of Jewish metaphysics, and that there is a very strong theological residue in not only in their writings and their thinkings, but certainly in the educational projects that grow up and around labor Zionism. And I also make the point that actually, in some respects, right, Judaism was like uniquely suited for this, that you could have a tradition without God. That was not a, and you know, nothing was more of an anathema to kind of, you know, British liberals than the notion of a politicized religion that had like killed off his central deity. But that is, you know, but that was very much present. But this point about there is something true here. There is a certain pragmaticism that you find among Zionist educators, particularly during the 1920s, when they recognize that most of their sources of funding for education are coming from the diaspora. And who is funding education in the settlement, in the Yishuv during this time? It's predominantly Jews who are more religious, who do not have this kind of very materialistic, secular outlook of Chavutzim, and that there is some sort of accommodation that would have to be made with these factions. But yeah, so I would...
Hi. I wanted to ask a question about this partition dynamic that you mentioned before, that... So is there a model out there of when there has been this kind of partition dynamic where things have like reintegrated or at least gotten better?
No, that I know of. the reality is, Ajay mentioned partition before, and you know, Greece and Turkey was the first modern partition of the 20th century, and it was a horrific like human suffering and bloodbath. But it was viewed as a success. In the interwar period, if you were a kind of statesman on the international level, you looked at that as a model, an example as to how one might deal with this problem of ethnic heterogeneity. And so rather than saying, well, why is that a problem? Because, you know, any numbers of communities have actually lived together for a very long time. It is ethnic cleansing, that is the word for it, of deciding that the state has to only serve the adherence to a particular group identity and cannot kind of serve its citizens in a civic model. I don't know of anything about kind of this kind of reintegration, although I think arguably that is what will have to happen in Israel and Palestine if we're ever to kind of put an end to the conflict and the bloodshed.
Thanks.
I mean, if I could just quickly add, the model, and some people find this very inflammatory, but the model most likely that most quickly comes to mind for that is, of course, the fall of apartheid in South Africa, which has not been, like, easy, and despite now several decades of black majority rule through various political factions, I think the sort of property distribution, things like this, still remain to be are huge, huge problems. A lot of what was given up in this sort of peace settlement meant that a lot of the problems persisted, but the initial position was simply untenable. I think that's the sort of inevitable conclusion that one is left with here. People often ask that sort of question. I think it's a great question. And one of the things that I think no one wants to hear about it is that a lot of people have to sacrifice a lot of security to achieve some kind of long-term lasting peace. And it's not just long-term lasting political peace. There are problems that are facing that region. I'll just mention, like, there's not enough water for that many people to live on. All those problems, desperate problems facing the region, facing the world, that are gonna require some kind of binational solution. And yes, balkanization is incredibly hard to push back.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, it's an incredibly important question. I wish we had better answers. But I will say, and I don't know nearly enough about this to say, but I know within certain groups within Israel-Palestine, there was a point where they were studying balkanization, the Balkans, right? I mean,
yeah.
Sort of like Bosnia-Herzegovina and certain attempts there to try to sort of, right, I mean, like form a more tri-national, as you would say, or multinational sort of society. I don't know enough to say how successful that's been, but I know at a certain point that that had been a model. I might just add, closer to home, I mean, on the question of apartheid, you know, thinking this question, you know, in some of the same ways as I think you invite us to think about a lot of the questions, but not as a kind of continuous process. And I'm thinking actually, I mean, really close to home, Jonathan Kozol, who has written on kind of apartheid education in the U.S. and sort of the question of segregation, and makes this really interesting distinction, you know, between, like, the pre-civil rights, the sort of legal segregation era, and then sort of looks at statistics today, where, of course, I mean, look at New York, like, it's massive. But you know, it's like, doesn't just assume that nothing has changed, sort of says we have to think about, on the one hand, you know, sort of areas or sectors that never segregated, and then we have to also look at the ones that did begin to desegregate and have now resegregated, right? So I think in any of these contexts, like, again, not thinking of it as a kind of, you know, once segregated, always segregated, but these, you know, like, the introducing, right, the domain, including in Palestine, like various methods of kind of like resegregation or re-resegregation, right? I mean, after, you know, attempts to sort of close the gaps have been carried out.
So on that, I want to, Jay, I want to actually kick back for a moment to something that you mentioned before about the notion that maybe it's not necessarily that we want a non-religious politics or a secular politics, but maybe a non-metaphysical politics. And I think that there's something definitely to say about that, but I kind of actually want to push back a slightly, because I think that, in kind of picking up off of your point, Tony, one of the most fruitful things that religious traditions still give us is a kind of concept of a messianic. And I don't mean this in terms of like a rapture, fire and brimstone, like, you know, Armageddon, volcanoes exploding sort of thing, but that the mere possibility... The mere possibility that things can be different, and at least I think that there is an argument for an understanding of the messianic in that terms, about that a different world is possible, that a different type of social arrangement is possible, that these processes that kind of tear people apart are not inevitable, they're not based in something which is kind of age-old and eternal, but that we actually do have the capacity through various forms of kind of human agency to change them. And I find that that's very powerful, but I also find that that is still somewhat a kind of a metaphysical politics.
That's it. I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, I don't want to quibble on the term. I agree with you, as you know. I mean, this is clearly, for those not like hearing the internal dialogue, right, it's a very Benjaminian sort of question, right? And I think of it, particularly within the Marxist tradition, that there is this sort of redemptive streak that Benjamin is one of the best people, Hertzbach as well, but Benjamin in particular is one of the best people who articulates and does articulate in explicitly Judaic terms. And I can see thinking about that as kind of a persistence of a kind of metaphysics. But actually, I tend to think of it as slightly differently. I tend to think of it as an allegory is not the right word, a metaphor is not the right word, but it is a sort of conceptual matrix that doesn't, that is built from the here and now. It's built from the world we live in, the one we sense, the one we can touch, feel, smell, taste, conceptualize, absolutely, but doesn't require a gesture outside or below the system for its own justification. So when I mean non-metaphysical or something like that, all I mean is that it's not been a gesture beyond. It's rather, and this is the sort of Benjaminian redemptive, right, is if I just rearranged, I'm looking at a room full of objects, if I just rearranged it in a certain exact way, we'd be living in a
completely altered world.
Yeah, no, I mean, people, I don't know that one could still say this about Israel and Palestine, but there was a moment, especially at a moment when there still was sort of struggling towards a kind of, you know, two-state solution, where people would say, and I think I would find myself saying this, in certain kinds of ways, like, you know, the binational solution is talked about as impossible, and the two-state solution as the kind of reasonable one. And I mean, on the other hand, you could have a binational state in 1 second by declaring it. So, I mean, you would have to then, of course, like create the thing. But I think it's a little bit maybe the kind of politics you're sort of talking about, that there can be like as against, and again, I think this has to do with our kind of rational sense of politics, that it's incremental and slow and gradual. There can also be these, you know, 1 second transformations. Right,
yes.
And but what has to follow them are like transformations of consciousness and transformations of the society. But you could have any of the situations we've described. You could have a trinational solution in South Asia if there was the political will to do it. If there was this sort of will to do it, then the question would be how do you sort of follow through on that? So, I think if I'm hearing you right, it's like the imminence, the existence of the thing, but also the vision to sort of right to find it, the will to do the thing.
Are there any other audience questions?
Yeah. Thank you very much. This is fascinating, and I look forward to reading the book. And because we're already speaking about social transformation, I'd like to connect it, well, I'd like you, Susie, to connect it again to education. And my question stems from your point that it would be wrong to deem both the Jewish and the Arab Muslim national movement secular, but at the same time, it would be dangerous to just think of them as religious. Meaning, it's tricky to attach the adjective religious to political movements. And my question is, how did that translate into the classroom or the realm of education at the time? And of course, how do you see it today, that tension between religious and secular in the classroom?
I mean, what you see on the kind of, I have a few chapters in the book kind of where I walk through a lot of examples and kind of textbooks and curricula and about, you know, how this is kind of enunciated at a pedagogical level. And I think I'll just maybe offer a few examples of that. You know, we have not spoken as much about the kind of Islamic education, Islamic side of things. So I kind of maybe will draw a few examples from there. But you see a very kind of conscious attempt to formulate not so much an identity that is either religious or secular, but something that just completely blurs those boundaries and doesn't make sense within that binary, that terminology. It doesn't actually make sense, and there's a kind of a concerted effort to blur it. So if you think about like European liberalism in particular as something which kind of, you know, creates this mode of politics where you will be like, you know, you can be like your religious self in private, but in public you will be like this neutral citizen that's like stripped down. This is actually exactly what they are rebelling against. You will not just be, you know, a Muslim or a Jew in your home. You will be that throughout your life and throughout your kind of your civic life as well. And in the educational curriculum, you know, for example, you see an attempt to kind of reformulate certain aspects of Islamic ritual or to explain them almost in a very kind of in terms of their social utility. So the Hajj becomes something that one undertakes in order to kind of make ties with other Muslims. And similarly, the fast during Ramadan is something that one undertakes from almost like a very communitarian or ethical like impulse so that one will understand what hunger is. So certain theological explanations for this are actually kind of stripped away, and they're re-narrated in these kind of socio-ethical ways. Which are very fascinating and which kind of convey to the child, I think, that there is, you know, that this is not some sort of just a theological system that's kind of that's segregated from everything else, but something which is supposed to be integrated into everyday life.
Steven, other questions? Tony or Jay, do you guys want to add anything else?
I was trying to formulate it in my mind. Because it's more branching off your answer than it is branching off the question. But you know, when we think about this sort of like, it's not a sort of the Weberian archetype or something, right? The perfect state, like the perfect nation state. It's France, right? And the funny thing about France is that, you know, we use these models and we say, oh, this is what European states are like. Actually, most European states have established churches. The German state funds, I think, like 16 different branches of Christianity and several Muslim groups, and I think at least one or two Jewish groups. Probably some Buddhist groups and things like this as well. Sometimes this is dismissed, right? So like, for example, the National Church in Britain, we just have this ridiculous royal nonsense. And people will say like, oh, the National Church of Britain, that's not a big deal, whatever. But actually, no, you trot out the cross, you trot out the globe, the cross rules the globe. Like these things are real. The sort of ideal type of a certain kind of laïcité version of secularism is incredibly violent. And not just that version of secularism, but that version of nationalism. One of the things that, you know, I think often gets sort of conflated and or it becomes annoying in the conversation about Palestine is a desire to make the case so exceptional. The case is not so exceptional. When the French state was founded, there's a wonderful book, Presence of Frenchmen, Eugene Weber. Yeah. They had to like obliterate 20, they tried to obliterate 20 linguistic groups, something like this. There was a lot of culling of different religious factions. It was pretty brutal. A lot of the things you associate with the genocide of Native Americans were done in France. So for example, taking children from their parents and raising them in different schools, unifying the language, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Part of what makes the conflict like less interesting than I think some people think it is this simple desire amongst many early Zionists to, oh, we're gonna be a regular-ass nation state on the Christian model. And it did regular-ass nation state stuff. That's what nations do. And actually, I wanna say nations, not necessarily states, because I do think there are political solutions to these problems. But it requires us thinking about, it requires us thinking past boundaries that say, the religious is obviously irrational and you can't talk to that, and the national is sort of pure and historical and true. It's sort of, this still like blows my mind. So.
Yeah. I agree. Are there any other kind of, I just want to see if any other kind of questions or comments from the audience? Yeah, Barbara, can you go to the microphone?
Well, it's just a short question.
Shout it out.
Can you? I don't understand the distinction between nation and state.
We can talk about that. You know, Jason, we'll let you talk about that. You're the political theorist on the panel. You get to be with the others.
You know, it's funny. yes, many people would say, would make the same, would ask the same question, and often the terms are used interchangeably. But in a very sort of technical, boring, political theory, political science kind of way, right? A nation is often described as, especially an ethnic nation, right, as bound by particular communal distinctions, right? Usually either blood, kin, what is it?
Language.
So for example, one of the cases we haven't talked about, and we've sort of been very global in this very regional conversation. Sri Lanka, one of the sort of bloodiest long-term versions of these kinds of intercessine conflicts is often portrayed as a religious conflict, and there were religious overtones between the Buddhist majority and the Hindu minority, but in fact, it was originally triggered as a language dispute. What will be the national language of Sri Lanka? Kin, language, ethnicity, or perhaps religion. These things are all sort of held up as binding together a kind of national group. There's a very famous book by Benedict Anderson where he talks about nations as imagined communities, the development of the printing press, and the idea of, sort of, for example, like newspapers, things of that nature, and right, I wake up in the morning and read the New York Times, and I can imagine another person in San Francisco waking up in the morning and reading the New York Times, and somehow we are bound together in a nation. That's very, very loose and very, very, that's like the loosest possible form. But a state, however, need not be based on a nation. There's a sort of, again, a very boring political science literature, but actually more interesting that I gave it credit for when I was in grad school, by people like Al Stepan, he actually died this year, the late Al Stepan, and his colleague, also late, Juan Linz, and they would call certain things state nations, right? For example, pluralist places like Indonesia, they used to count the US as part of this, I wonder if they still would if they were alive. Canada, Indonesia, certain places where the political sort of order seemed to conjure into being a sense of a communal whole. You could think of, during its sort of heyday, the Soviet Union is doing something like this.
Yeah, just to...
And it's also what the Ottomans wanted to do, but couldn't.
I mean, right, empires are kind of a classic model of states that are not synonymous with nations, where there are multiple ethnic groups, national groups, however you want to kind of characterize them underneath the rubric of a kind of common political form. Historians often talk about this as a difference between kind of the revolutions, say the American Revolution, that kind of come out of an Enlightenment sensibility, where the state will be something that citizens can access on an equal measure, regardless of their kind of, you know, ethnic affiliation. Of course, this was not actually the case in the time of the American Revolution, an imperfect project. But that is a kind of a distinct as a political form versus the kind of romantic nationalism that grows out of the 18th or the 19th century, in which like, we Germans will now be Germans in our German state, and the German state will serve the Germans, and we French will be French in our French state, and the French state is, you know, for the French. And that kind of equation between the nation and the state is something that really typifies the 19th century, but yeah, becomes very characteristic of movements like Zionism that also grow up in that kind of romantic sensibility.
If I could just add one more thing, and I know, Tony, you clearly have one more. States and nations are very young things. This is something that also sort of is very irksome sometimes in the discussions, particularly around questions of Palestine. People will say, well, there was a state and a nation here like 2,000 years ago or 100 years ago. Or no, state, like, even the inkling of an idea of a nation state, the inkling of an idea of a modern nation, like, at best, you're like later. I would say at best, it's like maybe you see it in the city states of Italy in like the 16th, 17th century, maybe. Usually, a lot of historians will use the Peace of Westphalia as the sort of, at least the sort of historical legal beginnings of the idea of the nation state. Why? Because it was there declared that there would be one prince, one religion. There would be some kind of match between the political order and the people. But this idea like does not go back to the ancient world. The idea that like your king would be of your people necessarily. I mean, yes, you can find things like that in the Bible and all kinds of places, but that was like the complete natural order of things, like was basically unheard of, as were like necessary features of the state. There are a lot of like, this is a sort of different literature, but a lot of people will be like, the state, that began in 10,000 BCE. Like, yeah, it didn't. Like the things we think of as states, like things with borders, things that make treaties, things that have modern bureaucracies, basically brought together by the functioning of and the needs of a rising bourgeois capital, that only happens like, really late in the game, 17th century, 18th century.
I mean, just to this question, and then maybe to bring it back to something Susie, you said towards the beginning about the question of like liberal politics and religion and the individual, and this kind of nation state question. But, I mean, you gave the Benedict Anderson thing. I mean, the two things I remember from that book, I mean, the newspaper thing, but I think there's a place where he says the moment when a nation has succeeded is like when you read in the newspaper about a plane crash in, you know, Greece or something, and it says 4 Americans killed, and you have some kind of effective relationship
right.
to that statement, right? Like, so then, like, there's no, you don't know those people, you've never met them, they probably don't live anywhere near you. But somehow, right, so that something happens in that moment. The other part of it that's important is the notion that, you know, people, like states are not things that people would give their lives for, but nations are, right? Like that kind of affect. And I think he has a line where he's like people, lots of people have given their lives, you know, wars for nations. It's hard to imagine someone giving their life for like the European common market. But you know, the response.
No, a lot of other people for the European.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's we're killing other people. It's easy, you know, by comparison. But the other side of this, and I want to maybe bring it back to this individual question and this question of like political rationality. I mean, my teacher Bruce Robbins, among others, kind of, one response to that is to say, true, but for example, lots of people gave their lives in Spain for the notion of internationalism. And lots of people are willing to sacrifice for affective models that are not the same as the nation. And you know, maybe that comes back also to the question from before about sort of, you know, successful solutions to partition. I mean, you mentioned this question of like the need for, you almost want to say the modern liberal version of the nation state is sort of the state will allow every individual like it to maximize itself. Right? This would be sort of the best version of neoliberalism, right? The sort of rising tide floats all boats kind of idea that like everyone can sort of realize themselves to their fullest. And you know, I mean, I wonder if there's another model. It would be the model. I mean, someone like Jim could see it writing about, you know, South Africa after apartheid. You know, sort of thinking like, okay, if we want an ethical response, one of the questions is like, how do we have to be different subjects? Like, how do we have to be different ourselves? Not like, oh, okay, we'll all live together exactly the same way as before, except some of us will not torture others of us. But so, I mean, maybe in this realm that you're describing as the religious is this kind of question. I don't want to call it sacrifice, because I was raised Catholic, so I hate the notion of sacrifice. But, you know, this sort of sense of other than, let's call it like other than sort of individualism, other than, right, I mean, some kind of a collectivity to which one could feel a sense of affect that's not the same as the nation, I guess. But also it's not the state, because you don't sort of like, you know, the thing that comes to collect your taxes is not necessarily the thing, right? I mean, it's but anyway, just to say.
Just a question, to your, about states, about modern, what's the difference between Babylon and France, if you
Babylon and
what the question is, the difference between Babylon and France, but let's, I want to collect this other question first, and maybe we can answer the concert,
A question, recently saw Mansa Marzouki, the Prime Minister of Tunisia, speak about their success after the Arab Spring movement, and he attributed it to getting beyond the division of religious versus secular, and instead making a concerted political effort to organize on the basis of human rights, pro-human rights versus anti-human rights. Is that a viable strategy in Palestine? Is that relevant to this discussion? Is it relevant to other places with partition?
I mean, I was going to speak to that really immediately. Yes, I think there's a lot of different matrices which we can kind of organize ourselves politically, other than this kind of category of yes, well, are you a Jew, are you a Muslim, are you a Christian? That these kinds of because actually what that does is that prevents one from actually having to formulate positions, because it assumes the position is already inherent in that identity, and it's not. And so, you know, yes. Something like, yes, we are pro not torturing people, we are pro elections. These are political positions that one can have from a variety of different kind of individual stances, and I think that that's absolutely the direction that we should be thinking in all sorts of contexts.
And that, of course, means pushing against a kind of colonial mentality. I mean, if one thinks of like the US democratization of Iraq, for example, I mean, it precisely was building a political system that was based on exactly what you said, there'll be X number of Shi'i and X number of like Sunni. So I mean, there's this way in which of kind of just add water version of democratization, especially in the region. I mean, Lebanon is another example where it's clearly just ground to a halt. But yeah, just to say that.
I'll add on this that, you know, we have on the kind of plane of U.S. foreign policy, we still have a lot of inherited assumptions about kind of Islamic parties versus kind of the good old like sectarian strongmen, or secular strongmen rather. This was kind of like the classic case with Mubarak, is that, you know, we will support the nastiest of regimes as long as they're not kind of mixing their Islam with their politics. Now, of course, if we use that barometer for politicians, and half of the GOP would be disqualified from office, but, you know, like leaving that aside, right? That we demand this kind of secularity from others that actually we don't really have ourselves. So one thing you see actually that's interesting about Tunisia is that you don't have the same kind of knee-jerk reaction to the notion that there may be that like actually people who like are observant Muslims might have ideas about democracy that are not totalitarian and that we should maybe include them in government. I had the pleasure of talking to two gentlemen from the State Department about a year and a half ago at a conference, and you know it was kind of in the aftermath of the coup to overthrow Morsi in Egypt, the kind of democratically elected president of Egypt, and to install General Sisi in as kind of the new strongman. And these guys I was talking from the State Department like vociferously defended this position that this was, well, you know, you can't have the kind of Muslim Brotherhood anywhere near kind of political power because, you know, they'll just oppress everyone. And I said, well, guys, that might be the case, but if there's democratic processes to throw those people out of power, then that is actually what has to happen, is the working of democracy. What you have done is you have actually, you know, democracy is nasty, it is messy, it is really, really difficult. But basically, removing a potential for democratic processes to happen is what has occurred here in the installation of Assisi. But my, you know, these guys from the State Department were adamant that this was, in fact, the right decision.
I want to answer that and these questions in order, but I just want to say that last thing is absolutely insane. I'll come back to that. The first question is a simpler one, but a very good one, which is this sort of like, why is Babylon not a state and why is France a state? Which I'm simplifying your question just for the sake of the audience. No, I think you had more examples in there. But this isn't like maybe, this is maybe more, it's definitional and it's institutional, right? So, for example, Babylon, didn't have definite borders. Didn't have a modern bureaucracy in the way that we might think of, like Susie just said, the State Department. The State Department has an identity of its own in a way that you wouldn't have even able to be say, like you couldn't have even said the Treasury, right, in an ancient empire. And for people to understand that as detached from a certain ruler or detached from a certain set of people. So the idea of impersonal bureaucratic institutions are very vital to modern states. The idea that the only, this is very Weberian, the monopoly on violence, right? Legitimate use of violence can only be produced from the state. It's very modern, did not exist in the ancient world. It was considered completely justifiable in many places. I'm thinking especially of the ancient Mediterranean, this is also true in South Asia, for certain kinds of communal violence to occur or interpersonal violence, and that was totally considered reasonable and absolutely, there was no like omnipresent bureaucratic abstraction there to be like, no, you can't do that. Things like borders, like those are extremely modern. Those are even younger than states. We've had modern states even longer than we've had borders. So like all these little institutional things, if you go to a parallel example, and I'll get to my final one for this, the parallel example of like Athens. Athens, right, had all these institutions, but they were people, right? So when you talked about the Athenian Senate, or if you talked about, oh God, I'm not gonna be able to name a single other office, am I? There were many other offices. They didn't have that weird thing that starts developing in the Middle Ages and then comes to full fruition in the modern era. Kantorowicz has a wonderful discussion of it called The King's Two Bodies, where you can think of the king, right, as an abstraction, the crown, right? Whoever watches that garbage show on, I forget what channel it's on.
You're such right? A party pooper.
I know. That show is terrible. It's just propaganda for the British Empire.
It's so bad. But it's nevertheless, it's so bad.
It's
so bad.
It's just propaganda. Nonetheless, so you get this idea of the abstraction of the crown and then an actual person, but this didn't really exist in the ancient world again. So this develops over time. And finally, the creation of the modern bureaucracy, weights and measures, a single uniform authority that declares all these things, was demanded and necessitated by the development of a market economy.
I just make a small remark. There would be hundreds of archaeologists who would not agree.
Oh yeah, I know, but they're totally wrong.
There was was treasury.
No, I do say there was treasury, but the idea of it as an abstract institution as opposed to an actual physical place or person.
I mean, the monopoly on violence part is pretty huge because prior to the age of where you have railroads, communications, you don't actually have a kind of technical capacity to exert that. You don't have a bureaucracy that can monopolize violence in a way. You need state armies, you need policemen, you need, like, frankly, telegraphs. You can know that there's a rebellion going on in 300 miles east of your capital.
Like, when the Romans built the that funny wall in Scotland, like, that was one of the earliest ideas even of a border. The rest of the empire just had fuzzy borders because who you paid tribute to. It just had a very, very different definition. Very quickly, human rights, yes, maybe. I'm not so jazzed, frankly, on the international human order of human rights. It's one of my, like, I'm not the biggest Arendtian of all time, but I am someone who thinks you do need states, the people you pay taxes to actually enforce things like rights. And I actually think that the key to Tunisian, the success of the Tunisian model, if people want to make it into a model, is very similar to the Indonesian one, which is that they did not sideline the Islamist parties. And in fact, Islamist parties, whether you like them or not, were invited into the process to participate, as Susie was just saying, was blocked in Egypt as full members, legitimate members of the political process. In Indonesia, this ended up meaning that the leading Islamists sort of ushered in democracy and then kind of like walked off the stage. It was completely bizarre. But this is the kind of thing I think people have to, you have to be willing to have risk in your politics to live in an actual democratic system. I totally agree with you, Tony, about loyalty to an international order. People would die for that. It does require sort of states to work from, but I do think that's real. You know, like, there's a joke I sometimes say, like, I'm an Indian Jew, right? But my minhag is communism. Like, and people have been willing to die for communism. And people joke about this, but people dismiss that it's still there. I mean, the Chinese think of themselves as good Marxists. I mean, they may think that, oh, they're just delusional about that. I don't think so. They think of themselves as good Marxists.
State capitalists.
I don't think they're state capitalists either. I think that's a misidentification. But then there's a degree of nationalism there for sure, but there's people willing to die for all kinds of things. And the question is, what do you want to die for? Or maybe what do you want to live for, which brings me to the last point. Right, the neoliberal thing of everyone maximizing everyone, all rising tide raises all ships, of course this is a myth, though, right? This is the ideology, this is the story they tell you. Actually, especially in this country, the tide has been going down for a long time. Whether we measure this in health, standard of living, cohesion, wages, incarceration rates going up, the tide has been very, very bad. This is true in a lot of other places as well, and in fact, yeah, I don't want to get into all of that. And so we really, really do, I think, have to think about how, you know, in thinking about like something like Israel-Palestine, right, you think you talk about a binational state, it's going to be a risky thing, and it's also going to be a sovereign state. And it has to deal with all these other problems as well, which actually does bring us into the Mubarak thing. When Morsi was undermined, people forget this. You can go back and read about the New York Times in that period. There was basically a capital strike where the industry of Egypt, which was heavily tied into the army, was just like, screw this. We're going to turn off the gas. We're going to tell the police to stay in the police stations. We're going to get rid of public services. Bread prices are going to shoot through the roof, and we're going to get rid of this guy. And it worked like a charm, including with the help of nice people at the State Department. The funny thing about this is, right, they got rid of the terrible Islamist Morsi and brought in the wonderful nationalist Sisi, who has proceeded to do everything ever feared of from an Islamic government. He has launched a campaign to eradicate queer life in Egypt. He has tortured people, he enforces Islamic law in various forms of public decor and things like this. And ironically, he no longer controls his own borders. It barely is even a state beyond just sort of an amalgamation of army and business. So anyone who looks at that and says, well, that's better than the Islamist option, I think that they are living in a delusional world.
I mean, that gets us very directly back to Palestine, because I mean, it's easy to forget, but I mean, one of the many things that has made Gaza Gaza right now is the fact that Hamas wins a democratic election. I mean, an election that is pretty much internationally regarded to have been a democratic election.
Demanded by George Bush.
Precisely. And, you know, and just lest we forget the bipartisanship of American policy, I mean, one of Hillary Clinton's declarations was that our big mistake was having the election. Right? Our big mistake was allowing the election. So, I mean, just to say that, I mean, that, like, yet another example in which, I mean, what would have happened if Hamas had been seen as, right, I mean, an actor in a larger political process, and we'll never know, but it's another case where it's hard to imagine the how that could look worse than what's happening now.
Right. It would have been nice to see Hamas have to pick up the garbage from the moment.
Pop more problems. Well,
no,
I think.
Oh, you want to officially?
Are we gonna? Is there any more questions? Because if not, I think we should probably let people go.
Yeah, it's about 10 to 8. I just want to say thank you all for listening. I hope that you found this interesting. We, you know, the books are on sale in the back, and Susie will be here for at least a little bit to sign them. We're going to decamp after that to a local bar named Ellie's
Night Shift.
This is very Brooklyn Institute. We're going to decamp to a local bar. Feel free to join us. We'll be there. And thank you all again for listening.